The world of work is different from what it was like a few decades ago. Anybody in the first few years of a career can expect more jobs and more careers than previous generations knew. But just because we can expect more churn doesn't mean we have to like where we are now. Our next guest wrote a book for people who want to find a better work situation. Julie Jansen has now updated the book, I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, and Julie knows from career changes, having made several herself. Since 1999, she's been coaching people to help them find jobs or change careers, and she's been helping companies make their workers happier. Her work has appeared in print or on air from Fox Business Channel to Fortune Magazine. This book first appeared in 2003 and is now in a second revision. Julie Jansen, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
So since the first edition, have worker moods gotten generally better, generally worse, about the same?
Yeah, so I actually revised it in 2010 as well, and so it's three distinct periods of time. In 2003, it was, as you may recall, the dot-com era, and so everybody was kind of running around thinking they can do anything and everything and have lots of money, and then it was the recession in 2010, and now, fast forward, in 2016, it's all about lots and lots of jobs out there, but a very competitive marketplace.
It's interesting that it's a competitive marketplace because the unemployment rate is low enough to make you think, when you just look at the numbers, that there should be enough jobs to go around.
Yeah, and there should be. What's happening is there are unemployed people, and you're right, the numbers are the lowest they've been in many years. Then there are underemployed people. And then there are employed people who are kind of keeping one eye open, saying, okay, I hung in there for all these years. Now I want to go find something better. And so there's a lot of people in the market.
Is it, given the general state of the labor market and the state of today's jobs in general, is it possible to be truly happy at work, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think so. I think it's possible to be 80% happy. So, you know, there's that 20% where you don't like your boss that much, or you're working on a project you don't like, or whatever, you're not paid quite as much as you'd like to. But I think that it's something that you have to kind of take charge of yourself and not expect your company, your employer, your boss to do all the things that they need to do to make you happy.
So, Nana, what have you done for me lately, but what have I done for myself?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly.
It seems like there's a lot more contracted labor now than there was in the 2003 edition of this book. How vastly has that changed?
Oh, incredibly. I mean, I just read, I can't cite the exact statistic, but just yesterday I read a study by a company called Adecco, and they said that the company is probably 70% or so of companies are hiring contract employees, freelancers, temporary employees, with the hope that if they, you know, they're either filling a gap or with the hope that they can turn them into full-time employees once they try them out. And that's like the largest trend I've ever seen.
What's the appeal? I mean, it sounds like part of the appeal are there differences in benefits for one thing?
Yeah, I think there's differences in compensation and certainly not having to pay benefits. But more importantly, companies don't want to make hiring mistakes. So one of the reasons that it's so competitive is companies are taking a lot longer to hire people. They're involving a lot more people within the company to interview candidates. And so by hiring temporary or contract employees, they alleviate a lot of that stress of making a bad decision.
So there are certainly reasons for employers to feel some enthusiasm, but how do workers feel about the contract or gig economy?
Oh, they don't like it. But generally speaking, they're realizing that this is the way they're going to get their foot in the door, and at least it's some sort of paycheck. And it also enables them to test out the employer and see if it's something that they want to do without signing a, you know, firmer contract.
So the relationship has changed just at its fundamental level about, you know, I'm here forever or not. But and how common is it for work in this day and age to intrude into your off time now?
That's very humorous. It's prevalent. It really is. It's, you know, and it is because of technology. People, managers, they expect if they're on their email at 11 o'clock at night, they are actually expecting a response from their employees, even if they have families. I mean, I hear this complaint over and over again as I go into different companies. And so it's an issue. So it's either the employers kind of set the rules and say, okay, we don't expect you to work all the time, or the employee just decides, I have a life, and so I'm shutting off my computer.
Well, you counsel companies as well as workers. So what do you say to the employers who do get into that vein of thinking, well, you know, I was up at 11:30, so I sent the email, and I certainly want their response?
Yeah, in fact, I'm dealing with a situation right now where two employees are upset with each other, and one is upset with the other one because she sends emails to her at 1 in the morning, and she finds that intrusive. And so, of course, I said to the person who sends the emails at 1 in the morning, that's just hit save and send it tomorrow in the morning at 8:30. You know, why do you have to send it at 1 in the morning? You're sending a bad signal. And she's just like, well, I created the email. Why can't I send it? And it's almost as if she doesn't understand.
So do have workplace conditions, and that would be among them, have they shifted beyond the point where workers feel any sense of control or input to the situation?
Yeah, I would say that there's the least amount of control and input that there ever has been. And I will say with a caveat that there certainly are companies where there is the exception, and maybe even some industries where there is the exception. But generally speaking, it's out of control with the number of meetings. You know, people have open schedules, so I can pop Jeffrey into my meeting, even if he doesn't want to go. And there he is, and suddenly he's seeing he has a meeting at 3 o'clock, to, you know, the pervasive technology that we just spoke about, to companies making these rash decisions about priorities and goals. It's a wacky workplace right now.
So is burnout at work more common than it was, say, 13, 15 years ago?
I would say absolutely, hands down, It is.
All right, we had a couple different flavors of burnout to talk about. We'll get to those on the other side of a break. We're talking to Julie Janson about the third version of her book, I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, a step-by-step guide to finding gratifying work. We'll get into some of the steps when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us with your phone calls and emails. Back with Julie Janson and you in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Julie Janson, who counsels both workers and employers about ways to make the workplace better. Her book, now in its third revision, is called I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, just out this week. It's a step-by-step guide to finding gratifying work, and you can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So you identify three different flavors of burnout in the book. What are the flavors of burnout here?
Yeah, and I actually have to credit a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who did the research on this, and I quote it in my book. And it's basically, she says that there's actually 22 areas of burnout, but they fall into emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, or reduced personal efficacy. And so it can run from, you know, feeling like you can't get out of bed, being very cynical about everything that happens at work, or just completely detaching. And it's become more and more and more prevalent, unfortunately.
Now, I know, Julie, you're not an economist, but I do find myself wondering in a couple of talks like this, why we have so many stressed people working too many hours and so many people looking for work, or at least more work, simultaneously.
Well, I think that people have hope that it's better, you know, and I think that that's what keeps people going. And so I think that they have to, you know, give themselves the idealism to say, you know what, it's got the grass, maybe it's not completely greener, but it's got to be a little bit greener somewhere else. And I think I can fix it if I go somewhere else. And that may or may not be true, because to the point of this whole book, people don't go through the proper process of trying to identify what truly will make them happy, what they're able to deal with, and then, you know, where can they go find it.
So we get into the book about the fact that there are different generations at work these days. We got the boomers in the process of retiring, Generation X, Generation Y, millennials, etc. Have the four generations at work, sometimes more than that?
So, well, there are still some traditionalists, as they're called, not as many in the workplace. The baby boomers used to be the largest group, and now the millennials, those who are born between 1980 and 1995, they're the largest generation by far in the workforce, and then the Gen Xers is a smaller group kind of in between. So So the millennials are really the ones who are influencing work in actually some very positive ways, as well as some negative ways. So they're the ones that are the future managers and leaders of the world.
Well, I wonder if some of the attitude is coming back from the other direction. I mean, if the companies using so many contractors view the relationship with the workers as casual, if the workers likewise feel like, hey, I can take this or leave it as well.
Yeah, and they do feel that way. And especially, not to belabor millennials, but especially the millennials who say, if my values aren't being met from the beginning, even an experience as a job candidate, let alone as someone, you know, as an employee, I'm moving on, and it's okay to move on, and it's acceptable. And companies don't like that. But, you know, at the same time, to your point, Jeffrey, companies are not encouraging any kind of loyalty at all.
Does it make any sense? I mean, I'm still curious about the reasons for that relationship. Is it simply a dollars and cents thing for a corporate master to say, you know what, we spend less if we just don't train as much and just let people come and go?
Well, there's actually a trend now where companies are panicking about employee retention. And so I've read survey after survey recently about employers trying to figure out how they can retain employees. So I think we're going to see a cycle now of companies coming back and saying we need to spend more time doing training where they didn't before. You know, executive coaching is an area where companies are spending quite a bit of money and continuing to do that. But I think that their companies are waking up and saying, whoa, we can't just keep losing all these people. It costs too much money to get them up to speed, you know. So I think we'll see this continue to change over time.
Julie Janssen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the third edition of her book, I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, A Step-by-Step Guide to Finding Gratifying Work. And Chapter 2 provides the first of many assessments in the book. Julie, what are we trying to find out about ourselves, particularly in these first go-rounds?
Yeah, I think it's the starting point is what really is important to you. So what motivates you? What fulfills you? And everybody's different, and I sort of encourage people in the book to, you know, come up with the top 10 list. So whether it's autonomy or independence or teamwork or building something or innovating or whatever it is, you need to know what those things are. So when you're going out there having conversations with potential employers or thinking about starting your own business, you know whether or not those are going to be fulfilled. And so that's key. And then there are other things like your ability to deal with change, the kinds of interests you have that potentially you might be able to incorporate in work, and then something called what I call favorite skills, which is, yeah, you might have a list of 30 skills, but which ones are you still willing to use? So going through that whole process is crucial to the whole, you know, the process of finding new work.
And I should point out, too, it's not just the nuts and bolts. I mean, you get to a list of values in Chapter 3, and I wonder if you coach people who never really think about their values and how they mesh with their employers.
I would say easily 1 out of 10 people think about their values or
really
have at any point in their life. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a very small number. And I'm not sure why that is. I think people start to think about that. Like I donate a lot of my time to an organization called Cancer and Careers. And when people come out of the other side of having cancer, they visit their values very closely. So it's when someone has gone through some sort of trauma, they will tend to do that more. But if they're kind of just bumbling through life, they don't really pay a lot of attention to that.
I imagine this could be something of a revelation that it's like, oh, wow, part of the reason I'm dissatisfied is I really don't care about the things this company cares for.
Yes, it is a revelation because, as you see in the book, there's a cross-check between these are my top 10 values and these are the ones that are fulfilled, and most of the time people are pretty shocked.
Well, so if, for example, you don't like the values of your current job but you like the money, I mean, we're just talking about adjusting your own particular set of values or just squelching that part of you, or how do you deal with a conflict like that?
Well, there's always the fear that people have that they're going to go somewhere else and not earn enough money or not earn as much money. But I will tell you that in my whatever number of years of doing this with people, money is rarely in the top 2 or 3 for people. They like their paycheck. They don't want to give it up, but at the end of the day, they'll be more interested in finding the, you know, kind of work that'll be more satisfying to them and bending a little bit on the compensation side.
So we go from values to attitudes and change resilience. And when we get to change resilience, I was not at all surprised to find you quoting lines from Who Moved My Cheese.
I shouldn't say it's a silly book, but, you know, it was a big thing in the corporate world for a long time. But the point is that if you can't handle change, you're in trouble because it's constant and it's never going to be different. You know, the attitudes I like because it sort of helps you take a look at your level of self-confidence, which is really important. It's your ability to manage relationships with people, your ability to be motivated and to be goal-oriented and to be professionally committed. And I think if you don't possess all of those in a healthy manner, you're not going to be successful.
So it's partly about boosting your own set of things you bring to the workplace, but part of that is meshing with the other workers as well. I mean, do you find some people who are really aware of their own sets of skills, their own strengths as an employee, but not so much aware of how they affect other people and vice versa?
Yeah, that would be the other book that I wrote, which is You Want Me to Work with Who? I find as an executive coach, the level of self-awareness, Jeffrey, that people possess is sadly low. So generally, it can run somewhere between 20 and 50% accurate. In other words, how someone knows, you know, what their emotional intelligence is, how they affect others, to your point. And so people have to do things to increase their self-awareness.
How do you get there? I mean, what are some of the things you do to and I know it's your other book, sorry, but I'm just fascinated by this.
It is an interesting topic, though. I agree. I mean, the way you increase your self-awareness, number one is the most obvious. You ask for specific feedback frequently, and you ask it from reliable sources. The second is that you pay attention, you watch YouTube videos, and you watch stupid reality television, and you look at the internet, and you read magazines, and you subconsciously compare yourself to all those people that you're watching and saying, well, you know, if I were in a house with 20 gorgeous men, I wouldn't behave that way. And you're subconsciously, you know, sort of using those people as role models, believe it or not. And it's odd, but it does work. And then the third is actually just yourself, which is mantras, meditation, visualization. I know I use mantras when I'm frustrated. I don't tell people what the mantra is, but it calms me down, and it works well.
Julie Janssen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book in now its third edition is called I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, A Step-by-Step Guide to Finding Gratifying Work. You can join us in the 10 minutes we have left with Julie at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. People tell you they want to change careers to find meaning. How variable is that definition of meaning?
Yeah, it's when I did the research for my book the first time I wrote it, and I learned that meaning was the number one reason that people did want to change their work, and I said to myself, what the heck is meaning, though? And so what I did is I actually identified 10 different types of meaning. So meaning is not what everybody thinks is like going and working for a nonprofit cause, which is one, and that's great, but it's also other things like being passionate. Like, I've never met anybody on that works in radio that doesn't love it. I don't know if you're the exception or not, Jeffrey,
no.
But no, but I mean, you all love it. And so that's the industry and the field is of deep interest to you, so that's meaningful for you, you know, among other things. Solving problems could be, innovating could be, learning, you know, so there's lots of different ways to find meaning, and very important that you know what that meaning is for you.
Now, I noticed that there are paragraphs of excuses in here, though, so it seems we end up conjuring up lots of reasons not to seek meaning at work.
Well, I think that by nature, people will tend to put excuses, as you say, or reasons that it won't work generally first before they'll find reasons that it will. And so that's why they're kind of up front and center, because some of those are real. I mean, people can be too old for a certain field or industry. You know, people may not have, if I want to be a social worker and I don't have a master's degree, I'm not going to be a social worker in our country. So there are things that are real and there are things that are not, and it's up to you to sort of weed through those and decide which ones you can test to find out if they're actually accurate.
When I think about the things that people potentially can do, and as I look at the list of things that crop up as people go through the exercises in the book, I wonder, particularly on the subject of entrepreneurship, how much hyperventilating there might be there, because you hear politicians all the time talk about, well, you know, we need more entrepreneurs in America to create the next best thing. If you have a great idea, but you're just scared, you know, brainless about how to move first, I mean, what can you do?
Well, if you're that scared, then you probably shouldn't do it, is what I say, being in my own business. But I think there's different, in the chapter on yearning to be on your own, there's a lot of different models of being self-employed. So do you need a partner? You know, should you go out and find an investor, like a shark, you know, I quote Shark Tank in there, like a Shark Tank investor, or do you, you know, is it something you should just do on a freelance basis or something you should do part-time? So I think there's lots of different approaches to being a quote-unquote entrepreneur, and so it's exploring all of those and picking the right model for you.
Do we all have a little of the entrepreneurial spirit, do you think?
I would like to hope so, but I do know some people who don't have any at all, so... I'm sure, you know, everybody's different. I think that, you know, a lot of people were forced into being on their own during that last recession. And half of the people, I would say, did great with it, and half of them did not.
So if you have a great idea, and the example you give in the book is the person with the monogrammed selfie stick, I mean, what next? Where would you likely go next?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to find out what the competition is. You know, there's probably a lot of, even since I wrote that, there's probably a lot of monogram selfie sticks on the market, I'm thinking. So, you know, is there room in the competitive landscape for another one? You need to do your homework on that. You also want to go get some advice from people who know what they're talking about as far as starting a business or starting a company. And I think you want to do some planning and kind of figure out what your own finances are and those kinds of issues. And how are you going to, you know, what kind of marketing and sales are you going to do to get this out there? And so there's lots of things that you have to look at, and it's a lot of information gathering and a lot of research.
I notice the internet can be the shooter downer of ideas. You certainly can check to see if anybody else in the world had your idea, and you'll know in a couple of seconds.
That's true.
In fact, it's out there. But in the midst of all the other stuff that you provide in here, I noticed that there are some websites that you recommend for assisting people in trying to move themselves ahead career-wise.
Yeah, well, the resource guide in the back of the book is completely new, so it's all updated with new websites. And there's even, like, it's a great organization, SCORE. I'm sure you've heard of it. And it's retired executives from different industries, and they provide advice for free. So all you have to do is set up an appointment. It's a national organization. There's local chapters everywhere in the country. Hmm. And so that's a great resource. I mean, but for me, like, when I started my business 16 years ago, I just went and interviewed three or four people who had similar kinds of businesses and said, what would you do differently? What did you do that you regret doing? You know, what does it look like day to day? Etc. And I found that enormously helpful.
Now, there's a self-assessment in here called the bruised and gun-shy self-assessment. What are we measuring there?
Oh, my. That's the person who's just been battered for different reasons. I know people who, I have clients who have been laid off 6 or 7 times.
Wow.
And they have to get back up and go out and look for another job. Or, you know, people who have nasty bosses. Or people whose company has been acquired 4 times. And that takes a toll on you. It takes a toll on you psychologically. Your confidence starts eroding, because that's your reality, is this dysfunctional whatever situation. And so it's very important that you do a lot to rebuild your confidence, and so that you can then move forward to getting yourself out of the situation.
Julia, there's an intriguing section here about sizing up your prospective boss. What do you recommend doing for somebody who's being interviewed about getting some information back the other way?
Well, the best thing you can do is try to find 3 or 4 people who have worked or do work for that person and hope that they're going to be honest with you. And the way that this prospective person treats you in the interviews, it can be very telling. You know, talking to people who know the person, asking the person pointed questions about his or her management style and his or her needs and what are his hot buttons and how does he like to be communicated with, and really doing your due diligence, because as you know, that person makes or breaks your career.
What are some guidelines for not running too far into the prospective boss's comfort zone?
But their comfort zone?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
In other words, not triggering them and making them start resenting you.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, you do have to be careful with that by not asking too many questions. But it's a realistic request to say, I just really want to make sure that you and I would work well together, that we would complement each other, and that's the reason I'm asking you these questions. You're probably, you know, hopefully you can meet some of your potential colleagues and ask them more surreptitiously about their boss, but you do have to be careful. Your point is well taken.
Lots of great stuff in the book. It's called I Don't Know What I Want, But I Know It's Not This, A Step-by-Step Guide to Finding Gratifying Work, now in its third edition, so it's second revision. Julie Jansen, the author of all three, and our guest today in the exchange. Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. We'll take a short break in the exchange. When we come back, the folks in the Barnstormers Theater in Grants Pass.